John Bewin is an AIR member. He's a veteran producer. He's a reporter who works out of Durham, North Carolina, at the Duke University Center for Documentary Studies. He's distinguished in our inner circle because John has trained hundreds of young producers and taught them the craft of audio storytelling.
And some old producers, too.
But what he does with the old producers is you sort of twist their arms and you make them give up their goods, is what he's done, actually. So in this book, which brings us here tonight, Reality Radio, Telling True Stories Through Sound is John's book. He's going to talk about it for a moment and tell us all about how this work came together. What was the inspiration, John?
How did it come about? You know, particularly as somebody who teaches audio documentary making, I had certainly noticed the absence of a book like this, but it never crossed my mind to do anything about it until 5 or 6 years ago. Some colleagues at the Center for Documentary Studies, who are in the business of making books — I'm not, I'm frank, plenty busy making radio — they said, we're thinking about developing a series of books on contemporary documentary work in various mediums, film, photography, so on. How about a radio book, and would you like to edit it? So, make a long story short, 5 or 6 years later, along with my colleague Alexa Dilworth, who's the co-editor and is the book editor at the Center, she worked side by side with me all throughout the process. Here we are with this crazy book. I think of the book as celebrating the creative wing of public radio journalism. And there are a couple of ways, I think, you know, it's sort of a book-length question, but a couple answers that I would give, ways in which these pieces tend to be different from what you hear every day and, you know, drive time on the news shows on your public radio station. One is that oftentimes the relationship of the producer to his or her subject is not the conventional one of the detached journalist who's sort of standing outside the story and telling the story, right? So that it varies in various ways. Some of these producers become characters in their pieces, or indeed are the main character, and it's their personal story, and you get, as a result, radio that sounds different. The other thing I would say more broadly that unites all of this work is that it sort of goes beyond the sort of packaging and organization of some information and sort of delivering that to the listener to become an experience. There's a sense as a listener of being taken somewhere, being taken on a journey, being introduced to characters who become three-dimensional, who you get to know, being told a story that you can walk into and look around for yourself. A very different sort of experience. And as Scott Carrier said in his essay, in his characteristic plain English, he says it's important to concentrate on showing rather than telling, because when you tell people something, they forget it. But when you show it to them, make them imagine it in their own minds, they remember it. This is how it becomes real. So all these people, I think, are reaching really hard after some deeper form of reality, and glad we can be here to celebrate their work tonight.
Thank you, John. Jay Allison, many of us know and hold him in such high esteem. He's a lifelong independent producer. He is a multi-Peabody Award winner. He's fathered many of us in the room. Sorry, Melissa. He's a founding member of AIR. He's a founder of the Public Radio Exchange, PRX. As Marita mentioned, he's a founder of the Cape and Islands radio stations, and he's a founder of Transom.org. I'm going to turn it over to Jay and our talent. Thank you.
I feel like we're descending through chambers deeper and deeper until something actually happens, which it will in a moment, but I'm here to introduce the Kitchen Sisters. But first, with the gubernatorial debate going on, I thought I'd quote a little something from the Constitution of our Commonwealth, Section 2, Chapter 6, written in 1779 by John Adams. And we're in public radio, we're sometimes accused of taking ourselves a little too seriously. I want to prove that that's true. As you listen to this paragraph about our state's constitution, consider the role of public radio in our society. Forgive the stretch, but this is what he said. Wisdom and knowledge, as well as virtue, diffused generally among the body of people, being necessary for the preservation of their rights and liberties. And as these depend on spreading the opportunities and advantages of education in various parts of the country and among all the different orders of the people, it shall be the duty of legislators and magistrates in all future periods of this Commonwealth to cherish the interests of literature and the sciences. Then he goes on to talk about the educational institutions, and he says, this is how they'll behave in order to, quote, countenance and inculcate the principles of humanity and general benevolence, public and private charity, industry and frugality, honesty and punctuality in all their dealings, sincerity, good humor, and all social affections and generous sentiments among the people. So that's a fitting mission statement for public radio, I think. And I think, you know, we're punctual, at any rate. And I think everybody here aspires to spread generous sentiments among the people. And so let's start with the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. I've known them forever. We traveled together in Alaska in the 1970s, teaching radio during the oil boom and all the little stations up there. And they've done hundreds of quirky, memorable portraits, things that you will hear and recall and talk about them much later. And I think they may play some of them. I've had the pleasure of working with them on projects like Lost and Found Sound and the Sonic Memorial Project, Hidden Kitchens. They're now working on The Hidden World of Girls. I recommend their work highly to you. They've won Peabody's and the DuPont Columbia. And they're fun to travel with because you meet people. They have a way of eliciting story. If you go in a cab with them, pretty soon you end up like in the cab driver's apartment. Or if you're in an elevator, suddenly you're at a club in a basement. Or so, because they have a way of engaging strangers and turning them into friends, which I think is really what their radio shows do. Muriel Rukeyser, the poet, has this line I'm sure you've heard: the universe is made of stories, not of atoms. And they live and work as if they believe that. So welcome Nikki and Davia, the Kitchen Sisters.
Jay's a little taller. Thank you all for having us and for WGBH and AIR opening the door to all the independents here and for everyone gathering tonight, not being at the debate. Somebody once asked Willie Nelson where he finds the songs that he writes. And he said, there is this river of music running near him, and he just goes down to the river and dips in a cup, and there is a song. And I think that about kind of captures what we feel in telling stories, that there's just this current of story that we just try and tap into. It's everywhere around us. Everyone is holding at least one great story, and it's our job to find it and then tell it on public radio. Talking to Strangers is the name of the chapter that we wrote in Reality Radio, and it's sort of at the heart of what we do, talking to everyone we know and don't know and seeing what needs to be told, what witness we need to bear. We love to collaborate with each other. We've been doing it for almost 30 years now, and with just about everyone else in the nation. That's what we've been doing, as Jay said, for the last decade or so, these big, sprawling, epic nationwide collaborations that involve thousands of people. Lost and Found Sound, Sonic Memorial, Hidden Kitchens, and the Hidden World of Girls.
When we were working on Hidden Kitchens with Jay Allison, we sort of had the West Coast and the East Coast. We were on each coast commandeering this this effort. And we plotted and planned and tried to imagine what's a hidden kitchen and what are the stories we want to tell, secret, underground, below the radar, cooking across America, and how communities come together through food. So we thought we were doing a great job coming up with all these ideas, and we thought of everything, test kitchens and this and that. And then we opened up the phone line, and this is this river of stories that Davia was talking about, and asked people to call in with their ideas. And, we got these amazing messages, and Davia and I on the West Coast would be driving around and listening to, you know, number 47 and calling each other. I live 2 hours from her, so calling and say, did you hear that one? And Vicky Merrick and Jay Allison on the East Coast would be doing the same. And I think that we were never, we couldn't believe the kinds of things that were coming in. We thought we'd just play one of the surprising messages that came in.
Message 23 was received at 1:10 p.m. today.
I'm Margaret Engel, a woman who works for Legal Aid, who's talking to me about how many of her clients get dinner. The people who struggle to even get food on the table because they don't have an official kitchen and who are using George Foreman grills and the like. The George Foreman grill has been an amazing success story as a kitchen appliance, but what I think many people don't realize is that immigrants and low-income people have contributed to that popularity. That is, to me, the epitome of the hidden kitchen.
Wow, what a wonderful story. I'd never considered it at all. I am George Foreman, 2-time heavyweight champion of the world, former Olympic champion, and king of the grills. Growing up in Houston, Texas, my whole life was spent trying to get enough to eat. Having 7 kids, my mother did, and there just was never enough food for me. I always dreamed about not a car, not a beautiful home, but enough to eat.
My name, Piggly Wiggly. I've got groceries on my shelf.
My name is Jeffrey Newton, Chicago. I'm a great cook. A trait that I had learned from my grandmother, but I just haven't had a kitchen. I'm living in a shelter at this particular time, but I've been homeless all my life. I lived under Wacker Drive, where the expressway goes through, and there's about 30 or 40 refrigerator boxes down there. That's going to be your home. I would get a George Foreman grill. That's the grill that I had for a while under Wacker Drive, me and a fellow by the name of Smokey. So you just get your long extension cord. Well, they got a lot of electrical plugs on the poles down there. And just hook up. We was making hamburgers and grilled cheese sandwiches. Because we used to take an iron and do that too. Press down, you know, your bread and your cheese.
My name is Pat Sherman, and I'm the program coordinator of the Walk-In Center here at Glide, San Francisco. When I was in these single-room occupancies, I couldn't cook in my room. But legally, I couldn't. I'd get me a big bowl, put me some ice in it. And voila, that became my refrigerator. Microwaves, toaster ovens, hidden under the bed or in the closet. The George Foreman grill, that's the newest thing. Doesn't set off the smoke detectors. And since they come in colors, you know, it just looks like you're getting real fancy in your room and decorating. And it looks like you have a nice tabletop to the visible eye. But you know it's your kitchen.
It's a special TV offer from the king of the grill, George Foreman.
My lean, mean, fat-reducing grilling machine.
I grew up in Houston, Texas, in the Fifth Ward area. Every day at lunch during the summer days, you'd hear the parents call the kids in. They would just tell me, okay, go home and eat your lunch. And these people knew I had no food at home. And I'd peep through the window at the kids eating, and the parents would peel the crust off the bread, and I would sit there and just hope. They would just throw it out the window for me. Going to school, you go through the lunch line, 26 cents. I couldn't afford that. And I'd sit at the table, and it was so embarrassing. So what I would do, I'd get a greasy bag, blow it up on the way to school to make it look like there was a sandwich in it. Then I'd get to my classroom and say, boy, I ate my lunch. And I learned to disguise my not having food.
When you're homeless, you have to find out all these things, you know. It's called trailblazing.
So that's a little bit of George Foreman talking about his childhood of hunger. We a book grew out of this series, and Alice Waters wrote the introduction. And after hearing that piece, she said, gee, I never realized I had anything in common with George Foreman before I heard this piece, because George has taken a lot of the money that he made off the George Foreman grill and built camps, summer camps and sports camps for kids. And when we asked him about it, he said, well, you know, it's the sports, but really I just want to make sure those kids are getting three meals a day. So his whole life was sort of fueled by this, his youth of hunger.
They say that you become the stories you tell, and today when we were being given, John Votes, he gave us a tour of GBH, and three different people came up to me today and told me they had George Foreman grills under their desks here, so you guys are holding. One of the huge other themes that's running through all our work is building community through storytelling, and one of those... When we were doing the Lost and Found Sound Project with Jay and the Atlantic Public Media team, we did found a group of women in Memphis, Tennessee, who were had been part of the first all-girl radio station in the nation. Sam Phillips, who created Sun Studios, recorded Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, Howlin' Wolf, B.B. King, you name it. When he sold Elvis's contract, he took the money and started the first all-girl radio station in the nation. And we stumbled onto this story by accident, and it has continued to unfold now across since 1999. And about a week ago, before we came here, yet another of the women who, there were 40 women who were part of this endeavor from 1955 to 1971, and we've become sort of the unofficial archivists and keepers of this story, and they keep revealing themselves to us and being part of our lives, sort of the pioneers who lit the path of broadcasting for us. So we can't help but want to play their story here when we talk about the meaning of stories to us. This is a little bit of WHER, 1,000 Beautiful Watts. Hit it, John.
Tuned to WHER Radio all day, every day.
We signed on October the 29th, 1955. The thing was, nobody knew that we were going to be all girl. Each girl thought she was going to be the only girl on the radio station. Dottie Abbott, who I hired as general manager, I told Dottie, and she almost shouted, I don't believe you, Sam. I know you're crazy, but you're not that crazy. You know, I mean, she was just beside herself. You were invading man's territory. I mean, you were supposed to be a guest or something if you're going to do anything as a woman on radio.
This is WHER Radio, America's first all-girl radio station. For sparkling, bright music.
I'm Becky Phillips, and I was one of the original WHER girls. At the first, Dottie Abbott was experienced. Marion Kiesker was experienced, and I had been in radio. The other girls were mostly new, like Barbara Gurley and Bobby Stout. And
my wife, Faye Becky, that's how I met her in radio. We were both kids in high school. Worked part-time at a little station in Alabama, our hometown. I'm Sam Phillips, and I'd wanted a radio station all my life. Radio, to me, it's a living thing.
My name is Betty Berger. My career started in 1956 when I went to work for WHER. Sam's wife, Becky, has a beautiful radio voice. And I think Sam recognized that, thinking, well, what would that sound like? Women playing records and music and talking and saying commercials and doing the news. That's different.
There just weren't many women's voices back then. Maybe some of the radio stations would have one woman who worked there.
WREC's charming women's reporter, Kitty Kelly.
We have with us in the studio one of the greatest living musicians, and I think one of the great musicians of all time, Mr. Sigmund Romberg. Good morning, Mr. Romberg.
Kitty, you are flattered. Really, I mean, you flatter me very much when you say I'm one of the greatest living composers. Of course I'm living. I love to live.
Wonderful. If you would, we'd like to know a little bit about your outlook on music in this country.
Tell me, did you ever explain to the listening audience that you have a wonderful smile, that you have blonde hair, and you have a red head on now and everything?
No, I didn't.
Why didn't you?
Because I think the people that come to our microphone are much more interesting, and especially you.
But I'm wait a second, darling. I mean, I'm interested in you now. The smile and the twinkle in your eyes. Tell me, Kitty, are you married?
No, I'm not, Mr.
Well, now wait a second. Now. Tell me, Kitty. I mean, how long are you in Memphis now?
Oh, all my life. But if I may say so, if you want to talk about me, I'd like to tell you of a very important part that you and your music played in my life.
Don't rush me, Kitty. Now, how long are you in Memphis?
So like we said, our chapter is called Talking to Strangers. We just thought we'd read you a little bit of the outtakes, the chapter that didn't make it into reality radio.
It was late. It was hot. The redwoods were curtained in darkness. We waited in the driveway. We weren't about to give up. Or were we? Another hour passed. Finally, a big truck, a big pickup truck, rumbled in. A young man sprang out of the cab and began unloading the tool chest in the back. The older guy took his sweet time making his way over to us. We were 22 years old, all fired up and ready to record. It had taken us nearly 3 months of constant calling to convince this infamous father-son lumberjacking team to let us come and do an oral history with them.
Les and Stevie Liebenberg were the last of the Mohicans, the only ones left who topped trees and worked the woods in the old-fashioned way. And we were there to chronicle their lives and their rites and rituals before they disappeared into the mist of history. We were on a self-appointed mission to document the vanishing traditions of work in the region for our local community radio station. This was our second interview ever.
Les and Stevie led us into the house. We threaded through the entryway, past the 6-foot piles of aging newspapers, the 5-foot towers of Quaker Oats containers, and the haystacks of rifles resting in the corners. We went into the kitchen.
The guys were pooped. They'd been up a tree for 12 hours. During summer, they worked long days till last light and didn't make it home till 10 p.m. It was 10. We were a long way off from an interview, a long way up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. The cell phone wasn't going to be invented for another 25 years. Had we mentioned to anyone where we were going?
We had come prepared. You could ask us any question about the lumbering history of the region, and we would tell you way more than you wanted to know.
The redwood blight of 27, the innovations in two-man saws that came about in the 40s, the impact of the building craze during the 1960s that was mowing down the old forests at an alarming rate. Les and Stevie, the king and prince of the tradition, could clearly see we'd done our homework.
Never have two men been less interested in talking about lumber. Les wanted to talk about a theory he had developed while ascending trees that explained the metaphysics of being. He called it the science. He carried a pencil and index card in his flannel shirt pocket to take down his thoughts as they came to him in the high branches. The trouble was his pockets no longer had buttons, and the notes on his revelations kept slipping out as he hung from the tall trees.
Les's wife,
Stevie's wife too,
had left him. Both women had moved on. Okay, it was time for the interview to begin. Nikki pushed record.
How has lumbering changed in the 50 years you've been in the business?
Can I get you girls a Pepsi?
Mr. Liebenberg, what is the most memorable tree that you have encountered over the decades, and why?
Stevie, show the girls the snakes.
The snakes?
The rattlesnakes. Nope, we hadn't told anyone where we were going, and now it was pushing 11.
We passed the pyramids of Quaker Oats and wove our way back around the rifles. How had we missed the floor-to-ceiling terrarium bathed in orange heat lamps with a boa constrictor and python climbing bare branches? We entered a side room.
Never have two men been more proud of their trained and tamed rattlesnakes.
All 36 of them.
Cavorting in the tool chest they had custom fitted to the back of the pickup. Even though three of the snakes had bitten him, Stevie had a knack and was training the snakes to pull miniature Conestoga wagons. To wear longhorns and sombreros, and to dangle from a trapeze wearing senorita gowns.
Long senorita gowns.
The guys were starting to get bookings at the Rotary and Kiwanis Club and were taking the snakes on the lumberjack rodeo circuit as well.
There's a moment on the tape, a night captured almost 30 years ago, on an old Electrovoice DO56 microphone when you hear one of us ask, "Can I touch the rattlesnake?" We were so lost in the thrall of this story, so mesmerized by the world we had walked into. Over a glass tool chest of snakes, we talked about Nippy and Nibbles and the Rattler families and their innate talent for showbiz. And finally, we talked about lumbering and the vanishing forest and family and so much more.
It's 2010. The Liebenbergs business card, the reel-to-reel tapes and the handwritten transcripts we did way back then sit patiently in the accidental archive we built up over nearly 30 years of telling radio stories together. Most of the time now, we tell people where we're going.
But sometimes we just go.
I talked to the rattlers for about 2 years, and then I found out they didn't have ears. We study the personality of the rattler. We don't study their anatomy. We hardly know anything about their anatomy. It's not important if they're a boy or a girl. It's just keeping their mouth closed, keeping their fangs from biting us. This is Eric Trussman. In the woods, when we take them for walks, we'll turn them loose, like three at a time. Let them get their exercise, smell their wild scent. They'll wander around, and they will actually come back to us.
Stevie started it. We found a rattler on one of our jobs. It was quite intriguing to have that rattler in that can. And so Stevie, pretty soon he got the idea if he could put a bridle on its head, then he could pick it up and pet it.
Well, that's Uncle Sam's head. Turn into the left.
The third head?
Right, third one with us. He tows a wagon.
So that's what those covered wagons are?
Yeah, right? They're rattlers towing. When the rattlers tow a wagon or wear a gown, Cupie here, the one sitting on the left hand, she wore a senorita gown. We have rattlers that ride a trapeze.
We'd like to see a series, something like Lassie, you know, only with rattlers.
The performing rattler is the whole idea. Did you see a rattler yawn there? He's getting ready to yawn again, maybe.
There
he
is.
They're very, very edgy. They rattle and they'll stand up like they're going to fight anything that moves. And yet, when you break through that barrier, they're very, very affectionate.
Can I touch the rattler?
That's a Studer reel-to-reel. All of us are very, very good, by the way, at editing with a razor blade and haven't done it in a long, long time.
Until we revise this piece.
Next, Ira Glass. We love Ira, and by we, I mean all of us in public radio, and that's because he's taught us. Many people in our industry resisted learning. They thought you had to speak only in big, strong, grown-up voices and betray no lack of confidence and permit no doubt. They thought we were to be the voice of record, not a record of voices around us. And Ira doesn't talk like that, and he doesn't ask anyone else to either. It's just such a pleasure to produce pieces for his radio show because you get to actually say what really happened and talk like yourself, which is surprisingly hard to do sometimes, I think, because, you know, then you have to kind of come to grips with what it is you really feel. And finally, on his show, you get the sense people are actually telling the truth. They're really being honest. His show is as fully strange and hopeful and funny and harsh and romantic as America itself, and sometimes all at the same time. The stories sprawl out of the usual broadcast boundaries. They're about the way it actually was and what it really felt like and what really happened. And Ira's their shepherd. And I think all of us here believe that to some degree that sharing stories brings us closer together, makes us less afraid of each other, lets us understand each other better. And Ira Glass is really our champion at this. So please welcome our true public radio hero, Ira Glass.
That was a really nice introduction. One of the reasons that I wanted to be involved in a book like the one that John and Alexa were writing, which would teach people how to do radio, is that when I was coming up trying to learn radio, I really could have used a book like that. I started working at NPR's network headquarters in Washington when I was 19, and I walked in the door kind of like somebody told me about the place, and I didn't know anything about it. I was not a public radio listener. I did not come from a public radio family. It was 1978, so there weren't really very many public radio listeners or public radio families. I feel like I'm saying this without false modesty, I was not competent at structuring and writing my own stories until I was 27, 8 years later. I now know so many people in radio. I have never actually met anyone who took longer to become competent. And one of the places that I went to learn during that period was the Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C., where I did some of my very first reporting. And the head of the radio station then was Marita Rivera, who introduced us tonight, the head of WGBH, who was very welcoming and encouraging. I made my living as a production assistant on the various national news shows, and then I would take jobs as a temp typist to fill in for more income. And I was really like I was bad at many of the basic tasks of broadcasting. And just so you don't think that this is some kind of like weird false modesty, I've brought a piece of tape to illustrate. This is not from year one, or year two, or year three, or year four, or five, or six. This will be from my seventh year. And I should say I was a very good tape cutter. I was very good at actually like listening to tape and being able to structure a story out of tape that much more competent people had gathered. But in terms of writing and making my own stories and recognizing a story, well, this will be a good illustration. This is from year seven of my career.
It's not such a long way from the local grocery store to the international debate over whether sorghum and meat production are causing corn to decline in Latin America.
Oh, yeah. That debate, which doesn't exist.
There's a general air of prosperity here, partly thanks to Mexican imports of U.S. grains, which help boost our farm economy. Mexico is now one of our biggest grain customers.
Just a little pause here. Now, if you're on the radio, just a little piece of advice. Don't emphasize every other word in a random way because it just sounds very strange.
Buying $500 million to $1 billion worth every year, including corn to feed its people and sorghum to feed its livestock.
What is this story even about? You know what I mean?
This helps cut our own trade deficit and benefits everyone in the U.S. economy. But in Mexico, this policy has led to fewer tortillas for the poor and unappetizing tortillas for everyone else.
Like, literally, everything you could possibly do to make something bad is being done here. Like, the writing is terrible. It's incomprehensible. It's performed poorly, and what's sad is actually the story is interesting. If I were to summarize it today as my current self, I would say that what this story is about is about farmers in Mexico, because it's very profitable to sell to the United States, where people have a lot of money. If you live in Mexico and you've got decent land and decent irrigation and you kind of have it together and you've got some capital, you basically grow food that's more expensive to sell to people up north who'll pay you more money. Which, as a result of which, people in Mexico eat worse. We eat better, so people in Mexico eat worse, which is kind of an interesting premise that doesn't get sort of played out here. You know, just like the language is stilted, you know, it violates one of the basic rules of radio writing, which is you should never say a sentence on the air that you couldn't with a straight face say at a dinner party to somebody sitting next to you. There's no pleasure. There's no sense of discovery. It doesn't seem like a human being is talking to you. There's no humor. There's no human moment. There's no fun. A couple of years ago, this back in the early days of This American Life, when we were talking about, like, we had a story idea. And I was like, oh, I did that story back in this part of the same series as this story. And I was like, oh, well, maybe we should see if that, maybe we could run that. And I sent Elise Spiegel, one of our producers then, to like listen to this old story. And she's like, wow, there's no sign you have any talent at all for radio. Like, literally, like, there's no sign that you're going to make it at all. And I think for anybody starting off in any kind of creative work, there's this period where you're not good at it yet, but you want to be good at it. And I feel like when we talk about like what it takes to do any kind of journalism or creative work, nobody talks about this period where your ambition is so much bigger than your own skill level. And I just want to say, and wanted to say in your textbook, John, you know, like that's normal. And it can take years to get past it. And the only way out of it really is to work your way out of it. Like literally to put yourself in situations where you're producing work regularly all the time, and you just get in there and you slug it out and you're a soldier and you just make one story after another. If you're making songs or films or just whatever it is, you just get in there and make a lot of work. And eventually, hopefully, you figure something out. And so that's basically what I did. And along the way, like I made up my own rules for what I thought would make something that would have a feeling to it that seemed memorable. And those would change. Like I would take any assignment that my editors would give me, no matter how stupid sometimes I thought they were, with the thought of like I would deliver this and I would deliver something interesting. And I had rules. One of the rules was every story had to have a tape to tape transition, which in radio means you're not just going like script tape script tape, because there's a rhythm to that that gets very boring. At some point it had to go like script tape tape, you know, sound, tape, script. It had to vary its way up. For me, that was just discipline. Even on stories that I was doing to turn around in 3 or 4 hours, which is a lot of the work you do when you're a reporter, I would insist on doing that. There also would have to be one moment in every story that was there just to amuse me. And that could be just like a little moment, something I noticed, some little thing, you know, just it didn't matter what it is, some like little human thing, some funny moment, some like little, just whatever. It was just there for me, because my feeling was I wasn't getting paid very much, so I might as well have fun. And I would imitate people. Like I remember it was a real revelation to me that I could actually just make a lot of headway by imitating people. I would actually sit and listen to All Things Considered, and I would log it as it would happen, sentence by sentence. I would like make notes on what they were doing and how many sentences the reporters took to get to the tape and how long were the tape, how many sentences were the tape. I remember the writer David Sedaris has said that when he was starting out as a writer, he would copy passages from favorite books. He said, I wanted to sense what it must have been to write those words for the first time. I would type them hesitantly, pretending they had just come to me. And for me, I felt like I was so sort of clueless about how normal journalism worked. I would basically go through those stories and really think about like what was working and what wasn't and what felt like something to me and what didn't. And I came to a sense of like here's what I think would work as the most compelling kind of radio story. And I did various sorts of experiments. All of my early experiments before this, actually, like I don't appear in them. Like I'm just recording people, and then I would edit myself out completely. But the structure I came to, and the way that I think of the most effective kind of radio story, I think of it as having two basic parts to it. And one part is the plot. And the plot I think of is in a very old school, you're telling a story way, and really what a story is a sequence of actions that really precedes as this thing happened and that led to this next thing and that led to this next thing and that led to its next thing. It's not about logic. It's not about argument. It's entirely about motion. And what you want to do is you want to get some sort of sequence of actions going. And if you've heard This American Life, like one of the things that makes us different from a lot of public radio shows is that we begin the show in motion. Do you know what I mean? The first beat of the show is usually me just starting a sequence of actions. This happened, then this, then this, then this, versus all the public radio shows that I worked on, you know, as a news person, where we start, you know, the hour with like a 1 minute little billboard saying, here's what's coming up this hour. And the reason why is because I feel like you want to just kind of get the dream of it going. And then the other part, the other element that I think you need for a radio story especially is that the plot has to drive towards some idea about the world. And you really need both things to be pretty surprising in the format that we're doing. That is, you know, in most of the stories that we do, or at least originally on This American Life, were stories that had nothing to do with the news. And so there was really no reason to listen to them unless they were inherently had a lot of sparkle. And we would look for stories. I would look for stories where the plot is very surprising, and where the idea that it would drive to was kind of had to be kind of surprising too. This idea about the world, and often we would get into this problem where we would have an interesting plot line, but it didn't really mean anything. Do you know what I mean? Like we'd have to go, like, what does this story mean? And just to illustrate kind of like where do you get the idea from, I would go into the interviews, and all of our contributors, we go into the interviews with theories about like what is this story really about? What is the universal something that it's about? So we could present those ideas to the interviewees and get them to react. I'll illustrate this. There was a story we did back in the early days of the radio show with Adam Davidson, and he's now one of the economics reporters at NPR. And one of our Planet Money team, this economics unit that we do as a co-production with NPR News. But at the time, he was not that. He was just a guy who we would put on the radio a lot because he told really great stories. And Adam's mom is Israeli. His dad is American, a New Yorker. And when he was a teenager, Adam read the biography of David Ben-Gurion, the founder of the State of Israel. Ben-Gurion, interestingly, was a compulsive diarist. Such a compulsive diarist, in fact, that Ben-Gurion was so convinced that he one day would be a great man that there are diaries that he kept when he was a teenager talking about his future as a great man. And so Adam is reading this, and he's like, you know what? I gotta do that. And so he started keeping a diary himself for his future as the future prime minister of Israel, which is seemed like a good job choice for a young Jewish boy in New York. And so let's just play. So we thought, like, well, let's have him come into the studio and just read a little bit from this diary when he was a teenager.
January 9th, 1987. There's so much wrong with Jews and Israel that I'm going to have a job ahead of me. One thing is the lack of any strong Jewish identity among most Jews. This attitude sickens me. I do not know what exactly I'll do, but if this situation continues when I'm a bit older, then watch out, world Jewry, here comes Adam. And watch out, world Jewry, here comes Adam was all in capital letters.
So I have Adam like walk through the plot of the story with me, and that's a lot of the interviews I do, really, like what happened first, what happened second, when did you start writing this, what do you remember about writing it? And so he sort of walks me through a little story about it, and he reads from the diary, and the diary entries are pure radio gold. But then it comes to the part of like, well, what are the ideas? And truthfully, like I tried like one thing after another with him, and this is the part of my interviewing where really just most things just really go nowhere. But finally, I thought like, well, what is this story really about? And I think what it's about is what kind of person constructs an entire fantasy life for themselves that's impossible. Do you know what I mean? Like, what kind of teenager decides, and Adam really did decide, I am going to be the prime minister of Israel. Like, that's a very particular kind of child. Like, who does that? And I had a whole sequence of questions with Adam where he talks about that, and it turns out, of course, he had no friends, didn't have a girlfriend, but he didn't have to think about that because he's one of the greats. He's going to think about his future life as the prime minister of Israel. And in fact, he there's one passage of tape in the thing where he talks about how now he looks back on it. He has this daily diary from when he was a teenager. It never mentions anything he ever does. He'd be like, I'd really like to know, like, what was my afternoon like? Who did I hang out with? Nothing about that in this diary. And so that kind of worked, but it still just didn't seem quite universal enough. So I throw one question after another with him. And finally, this question, which is kind of a random throwaway, got results.
And Adam, what would the 16-year-old you think of you now?
I think he'd be really disappointed. I think he'd be really sad.
Because you're not the prime minister of Israel?
Yeah, because I just have such a small life.
Yeah, I didn't expect this at all. And when he got to that, I felt like, oh, we're on to something really good.
I mean, I remember I was very disappointed and very sad about my parents. I mean, I was reading biographies, of course, of all the prime ministers of Israel. And I would just think about my parents and just think, how do you wake up every day knowing that your actions won't affect millions of people? Like, how is that enough motivation? You know, just to have your petty little craft and your petty little family and your small little apartment. Like, you know, it just seemed pathetic.
So this point, I've got, pause it for a second. At this point, I've gotten to the place that it's really hard to get in a radio interview where he is talking completely from the heart. And he's talking about himself, but he's also talking about something that anyone can relate to. And he's thinking, he's making up his thoughts as he's thinking.
And I mean, they have the kind of life that, you know, I mean, basically, I want for myself, I mean, just to have a craft that I enjoy and make a living at it. Have a family.
What you're saying, though, is that the 16-year-old you would be cringing at your 30-year-old version,
right?
Just as your 30-year-old version is cringing at the 16.
Now, this is me just trying to drag out the moment. Like, I'm just asking him questions just to keep him in this space.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. He would be very, very disgusted if he heard this radio piece.
And embarrassed.
He'd be really embarrassed. It would seem like I had settled in a pathetic way.
The other thing that I'm doing there is that the theme of that show that this was for was cringing. So that's why I'm using a question with the word cringe in it. And basically, like at that point in the interview, I feel like the interview goes from this being like funny little story to being something that is so like big and universal. I feel like everyone in this room, you know, we all have the things about our parents that there was some point where we just decided, oh, your life is so small and like I'm going to get out there. And you know what I mean? And then just the thought of like what the 16-year-old you would think of you as an adult. At the time that we did this story, I actually thought about that a lot. At the time that we did this, my current wife was then just my girlfriend. And I was just like, if the 16-year-old me could see this, she was an editor at Playboy magazine, and be like, okay, not only do I work at a radio station, I go to a radio station for my job every day, and not only do I own my own computer and my own car, but I have a girlfriend, and she works at Playboy magazine. It's like, on every score, so much better than I ever dreamed, really. And I feel like a lot of making a decent radio in this style involves luck. And like looking for moments like that, you know, you go out and you ask like a million questions, one after another. I could actually read you all the stinker questions that led nowhere, all of which are really embarrassing, but there's no time, and so you'll have to just buy John's book for that. They're in the book. And you know, you try one thing and another, and you know, when we go out on stories, you know, I feel like the most interesting stories are the ones where we just kind of head into it and we think like, okay, well, I hope this works, and then you just try one thing and another, and you go. Lately, we've been doing this thing where we'll go, you know, eight of us will go down to Georgia, and each of us will drive to a small town, and the challenge is to find a story in 2 days and bring it back, you know, or we'll go to a rest stop over the course of a long holiday weekend. Jay was part of this show, and basically we'll just talk to people until something happens, and a lot of doing this work is like that. And in fact, for a show in the style of our show, for us to find three or four stories that we think are compelling enough and universal enough and interesting enough and just kind of like just grab you, you know, just like grab something inside of you. We'll go through 15 or 20 story ideas often. I stand here now on a Tuesday night, 3 days from now and 1 minute, I will be broadcasting a show that I don't know what's in it right now. I know two of the stories, and then there's another five possibilities for what's going to fill out that show, and I don't know the order of it, and in fact, like, one of the things we might turn into something else completely, and that's kind of it. It's sort of like you run at a lot of things, and then you just wait for lightning to strike. And I think one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough when people talk about how to do creative work is, where do ideas come from? And ideas kind of come from other ideas, and you have to kind of run at a lot of stuff. And then the other thing people don't talk about is how important it is to amuse yourself. I think in general, you know, all radio, all work of all kinds just gets so much more interesting if you're really in there for yourself. Like, you're really in there actually to amuse yourself as you do it. And then if you just like take that impulse and you run at one thing after another, eventually lightning will strike. It always does.
It was fun listening to Ira from behind him and watching how he bounces, just the backs of his knees. You could just feel the kind of enthusiasm and pleasure, you know, rising up out of him. And that's the way your radio show sounds too, I think. Now it's my turn. Ira and I were both introduced to radio by the same guy, a guy named Keith Talbot. We use machines like that. National Public Radio was just getting going. It was in the 1970s, mid to late 1970s, and Keith loaned me my first tape recorder, a 800B, reel-to-reel machine, and just said, go out and see what happens. And I started wandering around the country with this reel-to-reel machine, they were very small, which was radical, because they used to be big machines, you know, when they would go, the folklorists would go out with these lumbering things, and thank God they did. But we came into radio at this amazing time when the equipment got a little smaller and we could go out, and not everyone in America had been interviewed yet. So they didn't know what we were up to, and it was a wonderful time to be in radio, and NPR didn't know what it was, and we didn't know what we were, so we could kind of invent ourselves together. It was it was the perfect marriage of youth. And I think in a way the rest of my career has been about kind of passing on that favor of that loan of that tape recorder. And I have a website called transom.org with my cohort, some of whom are here tonight, Sydney Lewis and Samantha Brown and Vicky Merrick at Atlantic Public Media, which basically has as its mandate to kind of pass on tools and ideas and practice and mission of public broadcasting. And in the pieces that are in John's book from Ira and Davia partly originated on Transom. The series we did, This I Believe, was essentially an invitation for people to tell their own stories. The Public Radio Exchange, which Jake Shapiro is here, is again a way for citizens to be able to talk to each other. But what I want to talk about tonight is actually our little radio stations in Cape Cod, which I founded with Marita Rivero and John Vosey, who are here. GBH manages these stations, and they're just the cutest little things you can imagine. They're down in Woods Hole, where I live, and they broadcast to Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket and Cape Cod. And we're in our 10th anniversary this year, and we wanted to... it was an amazing moment. It's an amazing thing to start a radio station because, there was an actual moment that it began. You know, there was static, and we all gathered in the building, and I got to say the first word, which was listen. And the static just sort of subsided, and then there was silence, and then a voice, and then it has never stopped since, except unless there's a thunderstorm because we don't have a backup generator. But except for that, on and on we go, 24 hours for 10 years. And we thought, what can we be that's not just McPublic Radio, you know? And I feel like the future chance for radio is in localness, because everything else, there's going to be another way to receive it. There's another delivery system that's going to be better. But if you're there and on the ground, most of the radio you hear isn't. It's being broadcast from a corridor in Denver, and they've just got your traffic and weather coming up on a computer. They're nowhere near. But our thought was, what if it actually sounded like a place? And we thought about, how will we do that? How will we also carry This American Life and Fresh Air and All Things Considered and all those things, which are, you know, broadly representative of the country, but they aren't about Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket. You know, and so how will we earn our place? We have a really good call-in show. We do great news reporting. We've won the DuPont Columbia for local as a radio station for a series that Sean Corcoran and Steve Young did on the hidden poverty on Cape Cod. So we do all that. But this idea that I had in the early going was, let's use all the interstitial time. Let's use these tiny little moments that happen between programs. And ultimately, the hope would be, let's put everybody on the air. And I'm going to just start playing these things. None of them will go longer than 30 or 60 seconds. We call them sonic IDs. That's what we call them in-house. They are little fragments and portraits. They are the voices of our neighbors that we don't know. They're jokes, they're poems, they interrupt the broadcast day, they're non sequiturs, they just pop out unheralded out of all day long. Play the first one.
We got out to Michigan on Lake Cinch, a beautiful spot. I hated the place the minute I stepped into it. I couldn't stand it.
The late Mildred Huntington of Vineyard Haven.
We finally got this place up right on the lake, very, very closer to water than this. I would walk down there, take a deep breath, and there's nothing. It's complete void. Didn't smell like salt water. There's no smell to it. I couldn't stand the place. I didn't like the food out there. You couldn't buy any baked beans unless you had the tomato sauce in them. I don't like beans with tomato sauce. Couldn't buy any salt mixed pork, so I could make a chowder. You couldn't buy any hardtack that goes with the chowder. You couldn't buy any New England rum, which Gail and I both like to have a drink of at night. There wasn't anything about that place I liked. It was horrible.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
So, I mean, that's a testament, see, to this place. I mean, it's a sort of backhanded, but, you know, so bit by bit, these people sort of pop out, and then
you realize, oh, wait, I know Mildred, you know, but you don't know this thing about them. Play the second one.
I only held the clock job for, 5 or 6 years.
Thomas Hodgson, former keeper of the clock at the Congregational Church in West Tisbury.
I'm afraid my confession about the ultimate reason for wanting to retire is that I don't really care what time it is. And I would rather... I'd rather rely on an internal clock than a machine, though this is certainly a beautiful machine.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations. And back to the news. You know, I mean, that's the thing about them is you get this sense that we live two parallel lives. One is this global one where everything's going on and the things we should focus our attention on and the economy and the rest of the world. But then there's just whatever is happening right where we live behind the doors of the person down the road. And I love this way that makes that evident. How about number four? This is a newish one. We have a couple new ones. I think this is Sean did this one.
We try to have fun here, and we try to be creative here, and we address the client's needs the best way we can.
Provincetown hairdresser, Dougie Freeman.
we're bringing back dancing and kissing. I ordered a stripper pole from Palomino Poles in Las Vegas, which is where the best poles, dance stripper poles, come from. And we installed it in the salon, and it was a huge success. You had to be under 200 pounds, and you could only dance 5 minutes. That was the stipulation. Also, we have a kissing booth going on now on Saturday nights, and then that's $2 a kiss, and it's kissing with saran wrap, which is another application for saran wrap, so that there's you have the confidence when you're kissing, the confidence of saran wrap.
Yeah, you're listening to the Cape and Islands. The confidence of saran wrap. That one ends with the sounds, I think, of kissing through saran wrap, but it's a little hard to determine. The best moments for me on this radio station are when they are just intensely there, you know, that it could only be happening in that moment and in that place. I remember one time when, I'll play you an ID from this guy. We have a guy who does the bird news, Vernon Locks, and he's just a bird lover. And he knows a lot about them, and he's a big guy, and he has a big voice. And one time during All Things Considered, he called in to the host to let Naomi was hosting, and to let her know there was a falcon in Martha's Vineyard. He called from his car, and he was screaming that because he was on his way to see it. The like of it had never been seen up there. Birders were coming from all over. He was trying to get there first, but he was so in the middle of the news. He was calling to tell her how thrilling this was, and he was going to, and what it, why everyone should care, and you could hear the wind rushing and honking the horn, and it was happening right then. I just fell in love with our little radio station at that moment. Play Vernon, he's number three. You'll hear what I mean.
These ducks are just the greatest show on earth, I think.
Vern Locks, ornithologist on Nantucket.
We're right at the end of Smith's Point. We're on the extreme western tip of Nantucket, and we're watching skeins and row. I mean, if you look out to the south, there's ducks low on the water, steady streams of long-tailed ducks. I'm looking at a group right there, 500 birds. There's 1,200 birds. There's 3,000 birds. This is just the most spectacular phenomenon. If we were smarter, we wouldn't be out here on the end of the beach exposed to the wind. And so you can actually, if you're looking right now, these birds, oh, my God. Look down the beach.
Oh, yeah.
You see, it's like smoke. It's like the, look at that. There's 150,000 ducks right there.
It's wild.
It's an ack attack. It's a whack attack. Attacked by ducks on ack.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
Ack is what we call Nantucket. That's the name of the airport. I think these things are most successful when you're listening and everything's going along normally. You know, public radio is just, you know, it's predictable and reliable, and you know pretty much everything's going to be okay. But sometimes one of these things comes on and you go, what the hell? And you think, and you know what it is? It sounds like a mistake. And that's when, and suddenly, you know, it's like getting lost in the woods. Suddenly you pay attention because you go, where am I? You know, and those are the moments that you're most keenly aware. And my kind of test for when these things work is if you were listening to the radio and one of these came on and you turn and look at the radio. Then I know that it, I will play another one or two. We have a little time, right? Because I have to tell you, I was listening. Play number eight. This one I had forgotten about. I think this is Sean's too. I should give credit to all the people who recorded these, but I'll ask you. Okay, that one.
This is the Board of Shame that contains numerous objects removed from the outside of people's bodies.
Dr. Robert Inslee of Chatham on his office exhibit.
We have a faucet up here that I personally removed from a gentleman that works at a local boatyard when he was trying to pry off a rusted bolt, and the bolt broke and he went flying backwards, impaling himself on this faucet, breaking it off, and then therefore having to come in here with a faucet embedded in his rear end. And this was removed, and obviously he did not want to take it with him.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
I will fail to give the patient's name because he's still roaming around here, and he would probably never be able to be seen downtown if anybody knew that that was removed from him.
He's got the Board of Shame had other things too. It's filled with fishing lures that people have cast and, you know, caught in their throats and stuff. And he says some of them are worth a lot of money because they're kind of rare. Ira was talking about these shows where the production team descends on a place and finds stories, like the one we did at the Rest Stop, which was really a gas, and the terrific show they did going down to Georgia, the Georgia Rambler. You should listen to that one on the podcast if you haven't heard it. But I think in some way, I think of the radio station as an extended sort of epic poem about documenting a single place in this way. You know, I mean, there's sort of a cliche that everybody has a story, and, you know, I think there are a lot of people who aren't very good narrators of their own experience, but I do think everybody has at least 60 interesting seconds. And I would love to just, you know, if we had unlimited budget, I would just sort of send legions of interns out. I would send, we do give out tape recorders and just go door to door until, God damn it, we got a story from everybody. this one, listen to this guy. I always think, just imagine you'd gone door to door and walked in and finally, you know, you get to like the rattlesnakes in the back with the bridles on them. But and this, so this guy had, this guy came up with this, number 7.
There were things that you would wait for every week. You knew it was going to happen sometime in the show.
Jerry Nelson of Truro.
Who knows what evil lurks in the minds of men? The shadow knows.
And the old timer on Fibromyalgia. It's pretty good, Johnny, but that ain't the way I heard it. The way I heard it, one fella says to the other fella says, you know, those kind of things. And Sergeant Preston of the Royal Mounties.
All right, Sergeant, I ain't afraid of that dog of yours.
Up, King, get him, boy.
Sergeant, get that dog off me.
I think I just really loved the introductions to things, you know.
Lamont Cranston, while in the Orient, learned to cloud men's minds.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands Anyway. Stations.
What you doing, mister? What you doing?
I played 2:30.
What you going to do with that?
He's still going. 2 30-second ones, and then I'll wrap up. Number 12.
The worst thing about living on Nantucket for a teenager is probably the boredom.
Stephen Hamblin of Nantucket. You're listening to WCAI Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard, and WNA.
That's all you get. It's only 30 seconds. But listen to this 30-second one. And this, I mean, it's kind of, you feel, I won't say. It's just top five.
My husband is a retired dairy farmer. A dairy farmer works 7 days a week. He had never seen the ocean. So when we were married, we came to the Cape so he could see the ocean.
Barbara Yamamoto of Harwichport.
His eyes filled with tears, and he said, I have to live here. And here we are, and here we intend to stay.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
But, you know, it's there are not many words. There's lots of pauses. And yet you just feel something so much about her in such a short space. It breaks up your day in a way to hear that, you know. So we also have a listener line. We'll put out questions when we're, you know, when we're doing well and we have enough time. You know, we'll ask things. In the early going, we just sort of ask people to call from their cell phones, tell us what they were doing. And I remember one woman calling saying, I'm waiting for my son in soccer practice and I'm looking out and the sun is setting over here. And wait, here he comes. He's coming to the car right now. Goodbye. And it was just, you know, stunning in its simplicity. You know, we'd say, it's Father's Day. Tell us about your father. Stories come in. You know, we did this series called Shortlists. I don't have time to play these things, but they were like people call in with lists of things and then tell us what they were at the end of the list. It was like a story with a title at the end, you know, of what the story was. And they'd be along. I would play them, but we don't have time. But they'd, you know, one wonderfully random list, and it was all the things that the guy had just buried with his dog. One is a list of public places all around Boston, and it was the places that the guy had slept because he was homeless. And they, you know, each one at the end, you know, Davia Nelson did one of all the lipsticks in her purse. That's a good one. Play that, number 20.
Twenty-four, perplex. 23, midnight. 19, fire on the roof. 16, bronze bottom. 12, almond ice. 14, sugar and ice. House on fire. Fire down below. Fire. Raspberry Dazzle, Mocha Chip, Mocha, Brandy, Brandy Mocha. Those are the lipsticks I have in my purse.
All of them were in her purse. It was just at a random point. Anyway, that's a good game. I think it's fun. The whole thing about this is to invite people. You know, it's the invitation of public radio. You know, come tell us something. Come out and play. And I'll just read this last thing because there was a woman who showed up and took us up on that invitation. Her name is Carol Wasserman, and she just showed up with a typewritten piece of paper with a commentary on it. And it was very, very good. And anyway, this is her writing later. Imagine that you're a young woman who has made several unfortunate choices and finds herself alone with her child on the hard scrabble coast of Massachusetts without a clue what to do next. You will take a succession of meaningless jobs for little money. State law requires an employer to provide health insurance to those who work 20 hours a week. You will be hired to work 19. You will spend your life providing the Department of Transitional Assistance with photocopies of your pitiful bank statement and your electricity bills, and frequently copies of your medical records, so that anyone might answer for themselves the question which you have asked yourself over and over and over, namely, what is wrong with you? There is nothing wrong with you, but you don't know that yet. You spend your evenings with the radio on, listening to the voices in the darkness. You spend your days in a factory counting things into piles of 10 as they pass in front of you in a conveyor belt. But when you get home, public radio is there to tell you what happened while you were gone. And this is where the invitation comes in. She wrote this essay, and Vicky and I produced it, and it was aired on All Things Considered, and then she went on to become a regular commentator and did maybe 50 or more essays, wrote a book, and she later listened to her own voice coming over the radio, and she said that she was amazed at the woman I had become. But all, here's what her writing. But all you have become is part of the achingly important institution of public radio, which pulled you from deep water and into the boat, which gave you a voice and surprised you with the news that there is nothing wrong with you at all, except that you had not yet told your stories, not yet learned to accept the invitation, which public radio has always extended to all of us, to listen, and if we will, speak up. Thank you. The question is, how long does it take to produce those little interstitial spots? They take a long time because they're heavily crafted. You know, I listened to some, and I would retake my voice in them just here. I thought I wasn't just the right tone there. Each one is custom to that piece. I have to have listened to it with you. I can't be popping in with a smiley face at the end. You're listening to the Cape and I, you know, you got to be in the same mode.
They're delicate. The good thing is if you go and find some of these, this thing sounds weird, I apologize.
Like but it takes like a day at least, I bet, between the tape gathering and the editing and the choosing, and then I bet a lot of them just don't go anywhere at all.
Well, you always talk about your failure ratio, your designed-in failure for your show, and the high percentage of things that don't work. And that's really what takes time, is all the interviews where they just didn't get anything good. Occasionally, you'll find a good one. You'll get four or five from a person, but mostly it's.
Do most of them not work out?
Not most, but I'd say a good percentage. We cannot get anything out of it. Maybe 20% do not.
That corresponds to my theory that like 10 to 20% of all interviewees are insanely great. 20% are just horrible and won't work. And then there's a 60% where, like, kind of on the right subject or the right day.
It's up to you.
Yeah.
You have to make it work.
It's up to you. You got to get in there and slug it out. The question is, like, where should local news go?
I don't know where should it, but
where is it going? I don't know what is happening. None of us have surveyed local stations. Maybe Jay knows more.
No, I mean, I know that everybody's casting about for trying to figure out what's next. People are trying to figure – radio stations everywhere are trying to figure out how to be internet stations, and I think in some cases sort of abandoning the radio. My experience being an independent producer and trying to shop new ideas and new ways of working and new shows to public radio is that there is a frightening number of public radio stations that are absolutely asleep at the switch, and that the managers are on retirement track, and the PDs aren't doing their job.
And they don't do much local news.
They don't do much of anything, and they just take a feed. And there is a surprise. Now, that is not to say they're all like that. There are great stations out there that are full of beating hearts, and there are people alive there. But there are many, many of the stations in this system are napping.
Can I just say, like, in response to your question, like, I don't actually, you know, I know the couple of public radio stations that I listen to, but I feel like when it comes to local public radio stations, we're in a moment in journalism where I think actually. Like, for one thing, like, I don't think necessarily local news has to be, like, the most super creative news. I feel like actually having people on the ground in local communities doing actual journalism will be a step forward in a lot of places. And in this moment where television news is losing audience and newspapers are losing audience and the entire economic model of newspapers is really in such a terrible shape, one of the weird things is that one of the few places in our country where journalism is actually thriving and the audience grows every year and income grows every year is public radio. And I feel like this is the time that we should be at our most ambitious. We should be hiring up all the local newspaper reporters who are getting fired from these local papers because the papers can't afford them, and they should be in our newsrooms. We should be having huge newsrooms. We should be doing massive fundraising, massive fund drives in the middle of this recession. Now, to like hire up those people and just expand our local news in a way that it's never existed. I feel like because of commercial media's problems in doing real journalism, a much greater burden is falling on the public media, public radio and television, to fill that gap. And I feel like it's a huge responsibility, and some stations are stepping up to the plate, and I think all of them need to.
I would add, I live in San Francisco, and both the stations there, one in particular, the smaller of the two stations, has really committed to its local news in the face of all things sort of cascading down, especially with the economic recovery. And then the other thing they do at the end of their local news is they always feature a local band, and they tell you where that band is playing. And I appreciate both things, that music and news coexist in that moment in our community.
I would also make sure, you know, the nice thing about public radio is we have a pretty good reputation for being mission-driven as opposed to being commercially driven. And I think we could call in some favors. And right now we are working a lot with all the newspapers in our region on both islands and on the mainland and New Bedford, and we call them up and we talk about what they're finding out that morning, and then that helps them because people want to find out more. They'll go to their websites or to their buy their paper. So we're trying to kind of form an alliance of all the journalists and have public radio be kind of the nexus. If I were running the station, I would extend that. I would find the best bloggers, the best independents, the best students. I'd be in all the schools. And I'd be the place where, and I would just be scanning the net for the smartest, most dedicated people in their little niche. You know, I mean, you know, I would take like our bird guy and try to find people who were expert in all kinds of things having to do with where we live. And I'd say, you're invited, come in. And I'd be calling them during the news shows and make us the place where it, the crossroads, the center of it all. Because it's good for them and it's good for us.
Do you mean, did we edit that tape or did we mix it together, make it louder? Or?
Yes. Did you mix it together?
It's a very primitive mix. It's just, it's pretty much, it's cut, definitely. We cut out a lot and we were there for hours. And it's, most of it's pretty, it's hard to listen to. But we pieced it together. We found the best rattles, obviously, and you know, used them when we could, but they were all there. Nothing was phony, and so
most
and we
of
did.
That
and we
that
did.
You're hearing is the rattlesnakes were constant for the 4 hours,
right? and we obviously mixed in some music.
One of the hardest part for us in the job is cutting the stories down. And it, when we started in public radio, it's interesting, we all, the year 1978 was the moment we started too. And there, you had a lot longer time. I mean, Irish shows so different, but a lot longer time to tell your stories. And for better or for worse, you be the judge, a lot of those story times have really come down. And so the humor, the complication, the more extreme parts of a story, the less easy to grapple with parts of the stories, I think we've been all, have had to push those parts of the stories away a lot. And that's one of the hardest things for me.
One has to do a lot of fundraising. That is a downside to it. I mean, I feel like in any kind of creative work, you have to figure out how you're going to pay for it. So I feel like it's not as bad as it could be, but there's a lot of fundraising, I mean, I think it's important that the fundraising is done in with the same kind of mission-y sense as the programming, so it's interesting to listen to, which then takes a lot more time.
Ira's the master of public radio fundraising. But the money is the problem, I think, you know, that for me, and bad editors. That's the worst.
Well, I love narrated pieces, and I love non-narrated. We're primarily non-narrated and have been pretty much since the early days of our career for a lot of reasons. I mean, there's two of us. Narrating is tricky. The I, the she, the we, the royal we. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why it's harder for us. Also, I think, I mean, I can kind of remember when it first happened, you know, the first time we ever decided to completely strip ourselves out of a story was because we realized that our presence was really changing the story, that no longer were you listening to this old guy, an old pool player, you know, in a smoky bar room telling his life stories. You were listening to two women interview a man about being a pool player in a smoky bar room, and suddenly our being there changed it, and I think that was kind of a moment for us. It's not a hard and fast rule, particularly. It's just how we produce. We love Ira's things. Jay's. I mean, Jay does a lot of non-narrated too. But
I mean, I do a lot of giving out tape recorders to other people, and then working with them, so they sort of narrate their own experience. And a lot of I find that it's a good way to work when you're tired of yourself, for one thing, which is, I think, one of the problems also with this work. I'm just bored to death with my own take on things. But giving out tape recorders and saying, you tell it, well, then what would you say? You know, and then help them write it and voice it, and it's everything then rises from the center of the story, and it's got a kind of authenticity that I can't do parachuting into their life.
Just from a practical point of view, one advantage of narration is it's a lot faster to put together the story.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're doing non-narration, it takes so much more time because every transition, every thought has to come from the person you're interviewing, which means that you're doing a different kind of interview, a much longer interview, where you're basically making them go over those things so you're sure you have it. And sometimes you just go, wait, I'm not sure. Just say that part again. Just like, what did you do? When? And you just do this because they said it a little slow or you didn't like the way they said it, but you can't say that to a person in an interview. And so you're just like, I don't know if the equipment was working for that one. You know, but when you're narrating, you can just kind of get in there and just be like, all right, they didn't say that well, I'm just going to say it. And you can just slam through stuff. You can be a much more productive person.
A simple explanation of that is like the unmodified pronoun. I mean, if they'll say something like, that was really hard for me, but they won't say what that is. You can write in and just say, and at age 35, he had a heart attack. And then you can cut to, that was really hard for me. But otherwise, you have to be thinking on the spot. He didn't say heart attack. I have to ask him another question where he's going to start it with heart attack, and then I'm going to be able to cut it. Did he say it tonally in a way that will cut with that? And you have to think, you have to have that thought on the scene. Or you have to spend weeks and weeks with the person and going back and listening to the tape and going, oh, I got to get heart attack.
Yeah. We always kind of think of our pieces as being highly narrated, just not by us. I mean, we have to get that person or a group of people or a piece of music or something to really create that story and drive that timeline or drive that storyline. So it does take a lot more time.
It hasn't changed for us because the kind of radio we're doing, I think, is really suited to the intimate listening environment of a podcast. I think it's just an accidental thing that the aesthetics of the internet match the aesthetics of radio when it's good. Like the internet at its heart, I feel like what it does great is that you feel like it's just you talking to whoever you're reading, you know, like on a blog or on tweets or just whatever. You really feel like it's like a one-to-one, like this person's just talking to me. And radio, when it works, has exactly the same feeling. And so sort of through an accident of aesthetics, like something which is good radio of the style that we're talking about here, where it's so intimate and you feel like somebody's just talking to you, just translates perfectly. And so we actually don't have to do anything.
The one way I could see it really improving our lives is that we could go longer. If the piece deserved 8 minutes 20 instead of 6 minutes 30, we would be able to kind of break out of the clock, which is just... pretty hard to work within those constraints.
I mean, the podcast experience, as Ira says, you know, whether somebody has an intentional experience, they put on their headphones, they set aside time. I mean, when you've spent the kind of time to craft these stories, that's very appreciated. But to use the word accidental, the thing I miss is the accidental quality of radio. And the thing that I treasure about it is the fact that these stories will interrupt your day in a way you hadn't expected, that somebody, you will hear something you never would have ordered on a menu, you never would have signed up for that podcast, suddenly it's there. I mean, the series I did, This I Believe, would air in the middle of the news, you know, and if there was a good one, suddenly the whole feeling changed. Or as Keith Talbot, the guy who gave us tape recorders, used to say that, you know, on the radio, you create your own time and temperature. That, you know, most people see that the radio is for the time and traffic and temperature, so you create your own. And that's the part of radio that's magical and I hope doesn't disappear, is the way it ambushes us and surprises us and introduces us to things we'd never ask for.
But bringing it down to like a more mundane thing, one way that it does change the production is that because we know people are now listening on headphones, which doesn't happen with the radio. With the radio, people listen in noisy environments and it's on speakers. But now that it's on podcasts, a lot of people are listening on headphones while they run or while they do whatever. On headphones, you can hear the crap edits that you know, you can hear listening through a speaker. Yeah, so you can't get away with as much. And sometimes, like we'll be editing on speakers, and then, you know, we'll go to the studio, and we'll be, you know, voice tracking, so we're listening on headphones, and suddenly we realize, like, oh, my, all the edits here are crap. Mm-hmm. And we have to redo them all because people will be listening on headphones. Back in the day, we didn't have to do that.
When we wrote our Transom piece that our chapter, Talking to Strangers, is based on, we opened it with this Marcello Mastroianni quote about why he loved theater, and he was devoted to an art form that evaporates. And he loved that. And I always felt that way about radio. It was part of what lured me into it to begin with, the mystery of it, the voices coming out of these speakers, the next song, what was the news, just, and now when everything is more, you can seek it out and it's archived. I think that's great, and we live by archival audio and thrive on archives, and yet I feel like it does shift it, that mystery evaporating level of the medium is just so divine, I think.